Hello and welcome to a new episode of the Equidemia podcast. My name is Selina Skogan and today we are talking about a topic that often sounds like history in the stable, but it really plays a role in everyday work because we are handling everyday genotype, phenotype, temperament and breeding decisions. We are talking about a domestication and I promise you it won't get too wild and it won't become too romantic human horse best friends forever story. We are looking more like how turned a wild animal into a partner and which side effects are we having and are we still breeding into our horses today. So we will talk today a little bit about the two waves of domestication in horses and what genetics tell us quite clearly nowadays, and what happens if we are trying to reproduce domestication under controlled conditions. We talk about foxes and wolves and a little island in Canada. And last but not least, of course, why should we as riders care about wolves and foxes at all? And what is it telling us about our horses? Little spoiler, it's telling us a lot because everyone wants their totilas in the garden. And that is not genetically completely neutral. So let's begin. So let's take a little detour before we are starting to record what we actually are recording. I would like to answer on a few of your comments. And maybe you also found out that the podcast came in a different order than what we wanted. This episode wasn't published last week, and that was due to me getting stuck at an airport and hanging there with a little bit of snow trouble. So I got stuck in Bergen. I didn't want to go to Bergen. I wanted to go to Amsterdam, wanted to pass my physiology exams. But I couldn't because I was hanging out on an airport and shit happens. I got stuck there. I came with a couple of days delay finally to the Netherlands and passed my exams there. And I can now say I am the proud first English speaking member. There's a few in the Netherlands already, but I'm the first belong to the first English speaking group. There's just one colleague of mine from France who has passed the exam with me, who got this piece of paper. Sometimes it's nice to have a piece of paper and just see, yes, we managed. who got this knowledge and who is able to implement that into their daily work. And for me, that was quite a game changer. It was very important for me to be able to learn, but also to see that because it has changed the perspective on horses for me. And now I can not only see, is it lame or not lame, but I can also see how loadable is the horse and how trainable is the horse and how can we, if we have, unperfect horses or unperfect life, how can we work with training? How can we add beneficial elements to horses to reduce the long-term effects of genetic imperfection and to hopefully enhance welfare for as long as possible? And that makes me very proud. And it's also always nice to cooperate with other trainers. And I did now in the last years all the education that were available from our masterclass speakers. Some were better, some were worse. And it's bringing the puzzle very nicely together. And I hope that our students will benefit a lot from that. And I also hope that our students are now, they are going into the second round. So we have done the beta test and now this year, the next masterclass will start at the end of the year. After the summer, we are launching the waiting list is open. The launch is after the summit, where you can save your spot, and the start of lessons is in September. So exciting times. And I hope that the next group will even, repetition helps, training helps, will even profit more from this than the ones before. Yes. We are getting better and better. That is so nice. That's really funny. It's really funny. And
that is one of the reasons why we have to talk about what we are talking here today. Ah, yeah, something else that I wanted to mention. I got a few notes on our last reels out there, and some were asking if I have started to work with a filter or if I have started to get beauty surgery or something. No, I just got a new phone. I simply have a better camera now, and I think it's adding the value. It's making me very happy. It's the first new phone after 2019, I think. So it was a very old phone, a very old camera before, and now we have been upgrading. Yeah, it makes me happy when the technique finally works. Now, yesterday I needed to upgrade my computer because that is also from 2019 and has been striking. It stopped working, it just went black. Tja, okay, we have to work on it. So, my friends, let's go back to the serious parts. Let's talk about domestication, and we have discussed that already a little bit. We have discussed the first early event of domestication in the last episode, and we were talking about the Botai culture from 3,500 years ago, nearly 2,500 years from now. Sorry, 3,500 before Christ, of course, long time ago. But what we also need to discuss is that this has nothing to do with our modern warm blood. So they were breeding on something completely different. They were breeding on, yeah, easy management. But they were not interested in possible riding. For our domestic horses, what truly matters is that there was a little bit later a massive genetic turnover, and one lineage spread and replaced nearly all others. That matters because it dismantles a little bit the romantic narrative that our horses have been the same for 5,500 years. Ah, no, not exactly. There was a replacement and there was a certain amount of reconstruction even. It is called the Dom 2 line or the Dom 2 turnover. There were done some large ancient genome studies. One of the professors I will have in the podcast in a couple of weeks, I hope you're as excited about that as me. I think it's really interesting what we can learn about that. Because the Dom 2, that is basically also the genetic signature of the modern domestic horse. And it was originated in the Western Eurasian steppe. Steppe, do you also say steppe? Steppe in English? I don't know. So in the Volga-Don region. And that happened around the late, third millennium. So around 2200 before Christ. This lineage spread within 600 years extremely rapidly across Eurasia, and it replaced almost all local horse populations then. That was the second wave, and that is much more interesting for us than for our horses today than the first domestication wave. So horses were then not only used, they became interesting also for riding. And one lineage appeared to be, extremely well trainable or extremely well rideable. And why it was like this, that is what we are having a look at now. Because what we think we know today, or what came out of this big 2021 Nature study, was the very strong selection during this expansion for locomotion and behavior. There's two major genes that appear to be relevant. We have one for locomotor relevance, and that gene is called GSDMC, and we have one for behavior regulation, so the temperament control, kind of little aggression, and that is ZFPM1. We don't need to remember that. We just need to remember we have something, or one indicator had locomotor relevance, the other one had behavior relevance. And if both came together, the horses were very well usable for what humans at that time wanted them to use. And it is thought that this quick spread was due to military use. So basically, the military used horses for transportation, has been extremely successful with that. Other populations were copying basically the attackers and wanted to have this advantage in narrow combat as well. And then, of course, they also stole their gene pool, or they stole the horses they have been working with, because it was so much easier with that than with a donkey, for example. So that part is simply breeding and looking at what others are doing and adapting that for your practice, right? And we all know that horses were extremely important for the development of civilization, and it was a very important, benefit in narrow combat or in war. In German, we say Kriegsentscheiden, and of course, nobody wanted to stand behind. Another study from 24 suggests, and that study was made on 475 genomes, so that's quite a lot. Well, I was suggesting that 2200 before Christ, you had this increasing reproductive control. So you got more structured breeding, and with that, a shorter generational turnover. So the humans living then have actively shaped the population. Now we need to start to look a little bit, zooming out, looking a little bit more global, because horses are, of course, not the only animals that got domesticated. There is a few others as well. And we know dogs and cats, but we also have cows and sheep and pigs, for example. And that is where it's getting interesting, because in the domestication lab, scientists were trying to reproduce domestication under, more protected circumstances, so we could understand what is happening there during domestication. And there was a guy, his name was Belyaev. And I love the idea that he had. So he had the idea that he is taking a fox and is trying to domesticate that fox. He has used it like, that experiment, like that has functioned like a biological mirror for decades. So the experiment started in 1959 in Novosibirsk in Siberia, at the Institute of Cytology and Genetics. It's pretty famous. You can Google it, the famous silver fox domestication experiment. It was initiated by our friend here, Dmitri Belyaev, and Lyudmila Trud was leading the practicals and scientific work for many decades. And yes, the experiment ran for many decades, and it is, as far as I know, at least, it is still running, and it's a really cool long-term genetic data set. Interesting here was the selection criteria, and that was behavior only. So, and that was a scientifically pretty radical part. He only selected, or they only selected, in one criterion, and that was tameness. So, how friendly and approachable the foxes were towards humans. Hundreds were tested per generation. And so, you see, they had a pretty big gene pool that was set up. And the approximately 10 tamest percent were selected for ongoing breeding. There was no training, there was no behavior modification, just the selection on tameness. The goal was to observe what pure behavioral selection does to the animal genetically. And that was pretty impressive, because they got pretty quick results and also pretty fast results. And that's scientifically super fascinating. Even though only behavior was selected, you got typical domestication traits that appeared. You got, after a few generations, already floppy ears, you got curl tails, and you got coat color changes, spots. Physiologically, you also had an impact, or the animals were also impacted. You had reduced stress hormone levels, altered stress responsiveness, so simply less reactive, and lower glutathione levels in the domesticated lines. And that is a sentence that should hit us as horse people, and sitting home a little bit. So if you select over generations for reduced aggression and increased approach behavior, you don't just get nicer behavior. You have a physiological impact. And that is important to remember, because you see already there on the outside floppier ears, curl tails, quote, color changes. The experiment is still relevant, because there's an ongoing debate about the universality of the so-called domestication syndrome. I think it's always good if you have a debate going on, because it's nothing is as it appears. So I think that a major part of working evidence-based is to be able to turn over your own opinion. But that doesn't diminish the core value of an experiment. The other way around, it's true. And that is also the bridge to our horses. So it's a real long-running genetic data set that we got there on the inheritance of behavior. And that is the bridge to our horses. If we primarily select for readability, we are not only selecting on behavior, but also on physiology, on neurobiology, and developmental pathways. If you're really interested in that, you should have a look at the summit and at the lecture from Stefania, because she's also looking at what happened in our domestication process and how what we are calling modern breeding, how that was influencing the stability of the equine body, and how many primitive traits, or how many traits that horses in free nature are still having, are absent in the modern riding horse, and why that has an effect on the neurobiology, but also on the physiology. So even if we order more rideability, maybe evolution has a surprise package there for us. And sometimes it's harmless and sometimes it is. And when it isn't, that is where the thing with wolves is getting interesting now. Then we have when we simply have a too narrow gene pool. And that is the moment where we are taking a little expedition to the wolves of the Isle of Royal. The Île Royale is an island in the Lake Superior, somewhere in Canada, where it's sometimes really cold. When it got really cold there last time, it was in the 1940s, the island was having an ice bridge to the mainland. And then one to two wolf populations, or wolf flocks, wolf families, were moving from the mainland to the Île Royale. Because next to the migration of wolves that happened there at the moment, there were only moose and rabbits. Wrong language, hare, Norwegian. Wolves and rabbits living. And they had a pretty good foundation there for their energetics, for their nutritional needs. Very little competition and very good nutrition. So that was a place to go. The problem with that is that it was only two wolf families that moved over there. And a wolf family, that might be 10 to 12 animals, but that also means a very, very, very narrow gene pool, because you have a mother and a father and their offspring. So very, very little gene pool. And then you have that twice, a little bit bigger, but still very narrow. And what happens if a sister and a brother are breeding with each other? Yeah, that we know, right? That we know, that doesn't have a good outcome. So scientists were hopping on the chance to follow this and to just look what kind of surprises nature has there in store for them. So no human was interfering. They were just looking at the populations. And then if an animal died, dissecting it and dissecting it and looking at it, what was going on with that animal and why did it die? So it's a textbook case of what happens when the population size is small, the gene flow is absent, no fresh genes coming in, inbreeding is increasing, and then fitness for survival is becoming measurable. Because from that moment on, when you had this rare event of an ice bridge, there was no fresh genes for the next 50 years coming in. So 1997, there was a migrant wolf, was again this rare event of an ice bridge. One wolf was moving over, but that was not good enough for a genetic rescue. It was a very short genetic event. No long-term stability in the population. Why is it interesting? It is interesting because many peer-reviewed papers are finding that 58% of the examined wolves showed congenital malformations in the cervical, but also in the lumbosacral spine. 33% had a specific lumbosacral transitional vertebrae defect. They also saw that there was a variation in the ribs. Some were not complete. Some animals had an extra one. And that the genomic analysis revealed extensive inbreeding. So the run of homozygote just became, not running enough. It got very narrow. And that was that is accompanied by structural skeletal defects. Why does that matter? That matters because genetic narrowing is not just less variety. It is influencing skeletal structure, health, the ability to reproduce, and finally also the ability to survive. And now we are coming back to our modern horse breeding. We're always there. So what does this have to do with our horses when we are moving back into the stable? And modern breeding has often the problem that some stallion lines, the successful ones, are heavily used. There we are again, that I've said somewhere at the start, everybody wants to have their Totilas, or everybody, when we are looking at the cold blood trotters, everybody wants to have the winning cold blood trotter, a very successful stallion that is now in nearly all the animals and has been narrowing down the gene pool extremely. And then you have next to this fashion, you maybe also have the selection on blue eyes or a certain color or whatever. So the line becomes extremely narrow. And we got another skill, and that skill is global semen distribution. We can simply distribute frozen semen everywhere, all over the world. And when everybody wants their totilas, it perfectly illustrates how quickly a narrow ideal becomes a collective goal. And then the problem is not the first generation and not the individual horse, but the generations after it. The issue is that everybody wants the same genetic blueprint, and that means variation is decreasing. And variance is not luxury. So variance is resilience. And I would wish that we would breed more for health and the survival, robustness, instead of this expressiveness. So it has been leading to a reduced selection for robustness. Tja, what shall we say? We have with that less structural resilience. Tja. Again, we are at the summit, and at the summit lectures, I think you can learn there a lot. So we are seeing then today more skeletal variations. Neck abnormalities are a thing, rib alterations are a thing, lumbar deformations are a thing. What can we say responsibly? Now, what we can say is that malformations in the cervicothoracic junction, C6, C7, T1, and first ribs are described in the literature, that certain bloodlines may be involved. We can say that. We can also say that there is still a big discussion about how relevant is that, how clinically relevant is that. And I know that there was just a new paper published where I couldn't believe my eyes, that they have been testing a comparably small number of horses, and the horses were only 5 years old and still stallions. How relevant, how clinically relevant the malformation or malformations in the neck have been. And then they said nothing. And I would discuss a point now from a different direction. I would say just let's have a look at the horses when they are 10 or 15 again, if they get so old. Because from my personal experience, so from all I know about physiology on one hand, but also what I have been here experiencing, on outside my back door in my garden with the horses that are living here with us, that is that with five it's just starting, with eight you see something, then you have a clinical impact. With four or five you can do many tests, but then the horse is still growing and the elasticity of the growing body is still covering up a lot. Even my wobbler horse under very good living conditions was first getting really relevant with five and a half. Before that, I saw nothing. So I'm not buying that. So I want to see more serious research, with a little bit more context, and I want to see bigger study groups and not only three horses. So that is ridiculous. So still, it's crucial to understand that we must be able to do two things at once. We look carefully when breeding. Concentration may influence structure. And on the other hand, we need to avoid hysteria. So even if we are taking a horse, or if we consider that a horse is not suitable for breeding, but variation does not automatically mean pathology. So even if the horse is not maybe a great for breeding, it doesn't mean that it does have no value anymore, so that we can't use it for riding or groundwork or whatever. But it's important to consider, I think. It's major questions thinking that we are looking out of our that we are looking out of our bubble. Genau. So how can we sum it up? We can sum it up and say domestication isn't over. It's called today a breeding goal, a breeding event. And it's still in process, and it will stay a process until we release our horses into the wild and let them do their own thing. So we are selecting horses towards our ideals, but every ideal has a side effect, and the body keeps a record, or the body keeps the score. And I would wish that we are again looking for a bit more robustness, that we are looking for survival skills and not only at a beautiful skin color or, high movements as a foal or something, but that we look at
how loadable is a horse, how well can it get old, and that we don't look at horses with 5 years, but that we look at horses with 8 years or 10 years or 15 years. Crazy idea. Are they still trainable? Are they still rideable? Can they still perform? And can the majority of this population do that? Or is it just the lucky individual? Many thoughts. So, in the end, I would like to ask you if you like the podcast, you are very welcome to please share it with your friends, keep us a like, and follow the channel because that helps us to get so much more independent of all the social media algorithms that I don't like to struggle with. I like to do something with horses instead. So enjoy the weekend. See you hopefully at the summit, and let's talk soon.